13. The War of Independence. The defeat of Toussaint in the War of Independence and his imprisonment and death in Europe are universally looked upon as a tragedy. They contain authentic elements of the tragic in that, even at the height of the war, Toussaint strove to maintain the French connection as necessary to Haiti in its long and difficult climb to civilization. Convinced that slavery could never be restored in San Domingo, he was equally convinced that a population of slaves recently landed from Africa could not attain to civilization by going it alone. His tergiversations, his inability to take the firm and realistic decisions which so distinguished his career and had become the complete expression of his personality, as we watch his blunders and the inevitable catastrophe, we have always to remember that here is no conflict of the insoluble dilemmas of the human condition, no division of a personality which can find itself only in its striving for the unattainable. Toussaint was a whole man. The man into which the French Revolution had made him demanded that the relation with the France of liberty, equality, fraternity, and the abolition of slavery, without a debate, should be maintained. What revolutionary France signified was perpetually on his lips, in public statements, in his correspondence, in the spontaneous intimacy of private conversation. It was the highest stage of social existence that he could imagine. It was not only the framework of his mind. No one else was so conscious of its practical necessity in the social backwardness and primitive conditions of life around him. Being the man he was, by nature, and by a range and intensity of new experiences such as is given to few, that is the way he saw the world in which he lived. His unrealistic attitude to the former masters, at home and abroad, sprang not from an abstract humanitarianism or loyalty, but from a recognition that they alone had what San Domingo society needed. He believed that he could handle them. It is not improbable that he could have done it. He was in a situation strictly comparable to that of the greatest of all American statesmen, Abraham Lincoln, in 1865. If the thing could be done at all, he alone could do it. Lincoln was not allowed to try. Toussaint fought desperately for the right to try. If he was convinced that San Domingo would decay without the benefits of the French connection, he was equally certain that slavery could never be restored. Between these two certainties, he, in whom penetrating vision and prompt decision had become second nature, became the embodiment of vacillation. His allegiance to the French Revolution and all it opened out for mankind in general and the people of San Domingo in particular, this had made him what he was. But this, in the end, ruined him. Perhaps for him to have expected more than the bare freedom was too much for the time. With that alone, Dessalines was satisfied. And perhaps the proof that freedom alone was possible lies in the fact that, to ensure it, Dessalines, that faithful adjutant, had to see that Toussaint was removed from the scene. Toussaint was attempting the impossible that was for him the only reality that mattered. The realities to which the historian is condemned will at times simplify the tragic alternatives with which he was faced. But these factual statements, and the judgments they demand, must not be allowed to obscure or minimize the truly tragic character of his dilemma, one of the most remarkable, of which there is an authentic historical record. But in a deeper sense, the life and death are not truly tragic. Prometheus, Hamlet, Lear, Phaedra, Ahab assert what may be the permanent impulses of the human condition against the claims of organized society. They do this in the face of imminent or even certain destruction, and their defiance propels them to heights which make of their defeat a sacrifice, which adds to our conceptions of human grandeur. Toussaint is in a lesser category. His splendid powers do not rise, but decline. Where formerly he was distinguished above all for his prompt and fearless estimate of whatever faced him, we shall see him, we have already seen him, misjudging events and people, vacillating in principle, and losing both the fear of his enemies and the confidence of his own supporters. The harmartia, the tragic flaw, which we have constructed from Aristotle, was in Toussaint not a moral weakness. It was a specific error, a total miscalculation of the constituent events. Yet what is lost by the imaginative freedom and creative logic of great dramatists is to some degree atoned for by the historical actuality of his dilemma. It would therefore be a mistake to see him merely as a political figure in a remote West Indian island. If his story does not approach the great dramatic creations, in its social significance and human appeal, it far exceeds the last days of St. Helena and that apotheosis of accumulation and degradation, the suicide in the Wilhelmstrasse. The Greek tragedians could always go to their gods for a dramatic embodiment of fate, the dike which rules over a world neither they nor we ever made. But not Shakespeare himself could have found such a dramatic embodiment of fate as Toussaint struggled against, Bonaparte himself. Nor could the furthest imagination have envisaged the entry of the chorus, of the ex-slaves themselves, as the arbiters of their own fate. Toussaint's certainty of this as the ultimate and irresistible resolution of the problem to which he refused to limit himself, that explains his mistakes and atones for them. Like Toussaint, Bonaparte did everything himself, and he wrote out the plan of campaign with his own hand. He divided it into three periods. In the first, Leclerc was to promise Toussaint everything he asked for, in order that Leclerc might establish himself in the principal points of the country. As soon as this is done, you will then be firmer. Command him to reply without equivocation to me, the proclamation and my letter. Toussaint was to come to Le Cap and swear fidelity to the Republic. On that very day, he and all his supporters, white and black, were to be shipped to France, without being disgraced, but with honor and consideration. This was merely to avoid irritating the population unnecessarily. No epaulette was to be left on the soldiers of a single nigger. Raymond, with no mass following, was to be arrested and sent to France as a criminal. During this first period, Leclerc was to treat Moïse, Dessalines, and Toussaint well, and every attempt was to be made to win over men like Christophe, Clairvaux, and Maurepas, who were favorable to the whites. In other words, men who had carried out Toussaint's policy and treated them with fairness and consideration. This was the first period, to last about 15 or 20 days. But Bonaparte had his doubts about Toussaint, Moïse, and Dessalines. If they did not come to swear fealty and be politely but firmly deported, they were to be declared traitors, hunted down by a war to the death, and if captured, shot within 24 hours. This would end the second period. On the same day, at all points, all doubtful persons, whatever their color, were to be arrested, and all the black generals, whatever their status, deported. The last stage was the disarming of the population. The National Guard and Gendarmerie were to be reorganized, in other words, made all white, and San Domingo would then be ready for the special laws. The first thing was to break the military power of the blacks. No black above the rank of captain was to be left in the island. The second thing was prestige. Bonaparte knew the imperialist importance of a proper respect for white women among natives. The ancients never thought a conquest completed until the victor had slept with the wife or daughter of the conquered monarch. It is difficult to inculcate the proper sentiment of inferiority in a man who sleeps with your sister. Bonaparte ordered that all white women who had prostituted themselves to Negroes were to be sent to Europe, whatever their rank. Leclerc was not to tolerate from anyone any talk about the rights of those blacks who had shed so much white blood. Whatever his rank or services, he was to be shipped to France. The Special laws were not specified, but the mulattoes, too, were to be suitably dealt with. Rigaud, Pétion, Vilatte, and other officers, having no fears for their own rights and thinking to supplant Toussaint and his generals, had obtained permission to come with the expedition. Bonaparte had them all put on one ship, the Vertu. If Toussaint welcomed the expedition, they were not even to be allowed to land, but were to be deported at once to Madagascar. If there was fighting to be done, however, then they would be allowed to shed their share of blood. Bonaparte, in these instructions, repudiated the idea of restoring slavery. He was lying, but he was still posing as the heir of the revolution, and he dared not commit this reactionary policy to black and white, lest it fall into the hands of Leclerc's successor, if Leclerc needed one, and for fear of the effect on the army. Even when he did give Leclerc authority to restore slavery, Leclerc kept it from his second-in-command, Rochambeau. Many officers, and all the soldiers, believed that they were fighting for the revolution against Toussaint, a traitor sold to priests, émigrés, and the British. It is on colonial peoples without means of counter-publicity that imperialism practices its basest arts. And what is staggering in this document is not its duplicity. It is the calm assumption of stupidity and trustfulness on the part of the black generals. Bonaparte seemed to have had his fears of only three: Toussaint, Moïse, and Dessalines. But the most bewildering fact in all this history, and the testimony to Bonaparte's knowledge of men, is that Pétion and Rigaud knew that they would be deported to Madagascar if there was no resistance. Yet so strong is the pull of authority that they were prepared to accept even this grudging recognition. The apparently impudent assumptions of Bonaparte were really sound policy. That calm confidence in its capacity to deceive is a mark of the mature ruling class. This accounts for its wild fury when it runs up against the type which never pays any attention to its most solemn protestations. Bonaparte was wise in singling out Toussaint, Dessalines, and Moïse. But for the first two, the whole plan would have succeeded. On February 2nd, Leclerc appeared off the harbor of Le Cap with 5,000 of his 12,000 men and instructed Christophe, commanding the troops in the town, to prepare quarters for his men. Christophe, poor fool, had had everything ready to receive them, and but for a quarrel between Leclerc and Villaret Joyeuse and an adverse wind, Leclerc would have had Le Cap intact. But Toussaint, riding hard from Samana, arrived just in time to stop Christophe. He did not show himself, but allowed Christophe to carry on negotiations, hiding in a room nearby and making Christophe speak loudly so that he could hear his refusal. On his way to Christophe, Leclerc's envoy, as if by accident, let slip some proclamations by Bonaparte calling on the population to rally round Leclerc, protector of their liberties, restorer of peace, etc. It was all that the petty bourgeois needed. The municipality and the civil functionaries, mulattoes and free blacks, always jealous of Toussaint's illiterate black generals and their low origin, and resenting Toussaint's despotism, gave demonstrations of joy and satisfaction. Stupid as only the petty bourgeois functionary can be, they employed Christophe to welcome the French expedition. César Télémaque, mayor of Le Cap, old, free black, and a notably able administrator, led this folly, gave an official reading of the proclamation, and pestered Christophe to submit. To add force to the protestations of himself and his friends, he brought a deputation of old men, women, and children to Christophe. Whites and all the formerly free were radiant, but the officers of the army, black and mulatto, were grimly hostile and would not speak to the French. Under the watchful eye of his chief, Christophe remained firm and replied to Leclerc's threats with counter-threats. Next day, the 4th, Christophe summoned the garrison, who took the oath to be faithful to death. They learned that Fort Liberté had been taken by the French. It was war, and Christoph called on the inhabitants to evacuate the town. Men, women, and children started the painful journey up into the hills that began almost where the city ended. A few inhabitants remained near Cesar Telemach at the municipality, hoping, in spite of themselves, for some intervention against this last and final misery. All had their eyes fixed on the sea. At last, as evening fell, a boat detached itself from the squadron and, taking advantage of the growing darkness, moved toward the harbor. Immediately, Christoph's scouts on guard gave the dreaded signal by the discharge of cannon, and at the sound, the soldiers, torches in hand, ran through the city. Soon everything was burning. Suddenly, with a terrific shock, the powder magazine exploded. Rocks loosened by the explosion came rolling down, crushing women and children hiding in the hills. By Toussaint's orders, all in the city, Whites and Telemach and his friends, were compelled to follow the troops. They came unwillingly, bitterly regretting that Leclerc had not been welcomed. Christoph and his soldiers, guarding the population, retired to the mountains. All night the fire raged, destroying property to the value of 100 million francs. Leclerc's envoys had told him how flourishing the city was, but when he landed the next day, he was welcomed by cinders and ashes. Of 2,000 houses, only 59 remained. It was an indication to the bitterly disappointed Frenchmen of the days that were to come, the beginning of a devastation which threw San Domingo back half a century. But even then, Toussaint still hesitated. On his way from Le Cap to Gonaïves, he met a French detachment. Stopping to parley, he was greeted with bullets and nearly lost his life. His horse was wounded, the hat of one of his officers was carried away by a bullet, and Christoph had to throw himself from his horse and swim across a river to escape capture or death. War is a continuation of politics by other means, and Toussaint was now reaping the reward of his policy during the previous year. The laborers, hostile to the French, did not respond to his call. They could not understand why Toussaint should call on them to fight these Whites when all his policy had been towards conciliation of them. It was easy for Toussaint's enemies to represent him as a tyrant, consorting with émigrés and priests. Everyone could see him doing this, seeking to hand the colony over to the British for the triumph of his own ambition. Mulattoes and former free blacks were openly for the French. San Domingo was a French colony. Why should they burn down their property for Toussaint's ambition? The army did not know where it stood. Christoph had nearly let Leclerc in, and now, wavering among the commanding officers, came to the help of Leclerc and further confused both rank and file and masses. Port Républicain, the capital, was under the command of Agé. Boudet, with 3,500 men, called on Agé to surrender the town. At a conference of the officers, the white officer in charge of the powder magazine refused to hand over the keys. Le Martinière drew his pistol and shot him dead at the conference table. Another bullet for Agé would have saved an infinite amount of trouble. But before such a demonstration of loyalty and the temper of others of his subordinates, Agé temporized. To Boudet's summons, he replied that he could do nothing except by the orders of Dessalines, his superior officer, who was at Saint-Marc. What sort of resistance was this? Thus encouraged, Boudet landed his troops and marched boldly towards the town. Another officer, a follower of Rigaud, delivered an important fort to the advance guard. There was some brave fighting at the last moment, but with such confusion and disloyalty in the command, the garrison could not hold the town. Trying in vain to set it on fire as they left, La Martinière and his men retreated. Not only was the capital gone, with little loss, and all its supplies intact, but the French captured the treasury with 2.5 million francs. The next night came an offer of submission from La Plume, the Negro general commanding in the south. Officers and men, as they had been accustomed to do in the political tangles of the revolution, followed their commanders, who in most cases had built their corps themselves. Even at Santo Domingo, where Paul Louverture was in command, the French had another easy success. Caversole, hitherto in Toussaint's service, had joined Leclerc and had been put in command of a French detachment. He marched on Santo Domingo and demanded submission. Louverture refused. A group of French and Spanish inhabitants attempted to let the French into the city, but Paul Louverture dispersed them. Yet even Toussaint's own brother, while refusing to admit Caversole, wrote to the governor asking for orders. Where Toussaint's own brother was so uncertain, what could the masses do? Only then did Toussaint write commanding him to defend to the last, and even to the extent of capturing Caversole and his troops, a miserable and telltale indication of vacillation. Afraid that his messengers might be captured, Toussaint gave his couriers another letter counseling Paul to conciliation. This letter the officers, two blacks and a white, in case of arrest, were to present to their captors, hiding the genuine instructions. The officers were killed, and both letters were found on them. Caversole sent the false letter to Paul, who opened the gates and let Caversole in. Moville, the bishop of San Domingo, had long been working on Clairvaux, second in rank of Toussaint's officers. Clairvaux in a few days would yield to Moville and surrender to the French. It was treason, but it was an easy treason, after he had heard that Toussaint's own brother, his subordinate, had let Caversole in, apparently on Toussaint's instructions. The French welcomed Toussaint's officers and men and treated them as comrades. The masses looked on, confused, bewildered, not knowing what to do. Fortunately for these misguided chiefs, Toussaint, Dessalines, and Maurepas paid no attention to Leclerc's proclamations. It was this that saved the traitors, for Bonaparte's instructions were explicit, and but for the resistance of the so-called enemies of France, the epaulets would have been torn from the shoulders of these stupidly trustful blacks. On February 10th, Maurepas, holding Port-de-Paix, the strongest position on the north coast, was attacked by 1,500 troops under de Belle and menaced by the guns of the fleet. Refusing to capitulate, he retired from the town and took up his position in the mountains. But Rochambeau took Fort Dauphin, and thus, except for Saint-Marc under Dessalines, nearly the whole littoral was in the hands of Leclerc. Toussaint, on February 8th, did not yet know the full extent of his reverses, but as the blows fell upon him, he braced himself, not for surrender, but for resistance. The dream of orderly government and progress to civilization was over. He had held on to the last shred of hope for peace, but as he saw the enemy closing in, then and then only did he prepare to fight. Grievous had been his error, but as soon as he decided to look the destruction of San Domingo fairly in the face, he rose to the peril. And this, his last campaign, was his greatest. He outlined his plan to Dessalines. "Do not forget, while waiting for the rainy season which will rid us of our foes, that we have no other resource than destruction and fire. Bear in mind that the soil bathed with our sweat must not furnish our enemies with the smallest sustenance. Tear up the roads with shot. Throw corpses and horses into all the fountains. Burn and annihilate everything in order that those who have come to reduce us to slavery may have before their eyes the image of that hell which they deserve." It was too late. Events were to show that if he had but mobilized the masses before and purged his army, the French attack would have been crippled at the start. His desire to avoid destruction was the very thing that caused it. It is the recurring error of moderates when face to face with a revolutionary struggle. Dessalines never got the letter, but the superb soldier and revolutionary leader was a man far different from Christoph and the rest. He needed neither instructions nor exhortation to take appropriate action. When he heard that Port Republican was taken, he paled through his black skin, turned fiercely to curse those around him, and bellowed with wrath. Such a thing should never have happened, and it was all Toussaint's fault. The French had the initiative, and Dessalines did not wait to be attacked. Marching south to meet them, he made contact with La Martinière at La Croix des Bouquets. Fainting as if to retreat into the Cahos Mountains, he sent the French on a false scent and speeded to Léogâne, a town rich in resources and the port of a fertile and flourishing plain. Boudet sent a division after him, but Dessalines got to Léogâne first, burnt it to the ground, and devastated the plain. He was now in a critical position. He could go no further into the south. La Plume threatened him there. Boudet's pursuing division and Boudet himself at Port Republicain barred his retreat, and 900 men landed at Arcaille put that seaport town in the hands of the French. Only the uncharted mountains offered an escape. High over frightful precipices and unknown paths, Dessalines led his men. The waiting French never saw him, and after a series of forced marches, he got back to Saint-Marc, reorganized his forces, and then marched south again to meet the French and check them in their advance on his headquarters. Boudet was attacking by sea and land. Making use of every difficulty of the difficult road, Dessalines made Boudet fight every inch of the way, and the French advance had continually to be cleared by artillery. In the final engagement, Dessalines was defeated, but after such a harassing march and murderous combat that Boudet's men lay exhausted and could not follow the retreating army. Taking his time, Dessalines retired to Saint-Marc. On the parade ground, he had kept a huge fire burning for 2 days, and he had filled the town and his own recently completed palace with inflammable material. Lighting a torch with his own hand, he applied it to his house, while his soldiers followed his example throughout the town. Boudet, like Leclerc, marched into ruins. But weary and dispirited as were the French, they were to have no peace, for Dessalines, judging that the garrison at Port Republicain would be depleted, now set off south again at top speed, intending to surprise the town, take it by assault, and burn it to the ground. As he ranged from one part of the island to another, wearing out these inhuman persecutors of his people, this old slave, with the marks of the whip below his general's uniform, was fast coming to the conclusion at which Toussaint still boggled. He would declare the island independent and finish with France. The old slave owners were everywhere grinning with joy at the French expedition. He would finish with everything white forever. Men, women, and children, indeed, all the whites who came into his hands, he massacred. And forbidding burial, he left stacks of corpses rotting in the sun to strike terror into the French detachments as they toiled behind his flying columns. Leclerc now tried to get hold of Toussaint by using his own sons to decoy him. It had been a plot carefully laid by Bonaparte in Paris as far back as the previous October. Bonaparte would not send the boys back, and Toussaint's enemies did not scruple to try turning their minds against him. But when the time came for the expedition, Bonaparte sent for them and their tutor, the Abbé Coisnon. He spoke kindly to them, gave them presents, told them what a great man their father was, how well he had served France, assured them that the expedition was merely to strengthen San Domingo against its enemies, told them that he would send them on in advance to tell their father all this, and asked their tutor to undertake the journey with them. His priestly vocation would help. He had high officials entertain them to dinner. By some chance, the boys were not sent on in advance, but they and their tutor sailed with Leclerc. Bonaparte had given Leclerc a long rigmarole of a letter, signed with his own hand at last, guaranteeing liberty to the blacks, and asking Toussaint to assist Leclerc in the government of the country, presumably for the week or so before he was shipped off to France, all with an undercurrent of threats against him if he resisted. This Leclerc now dispatched to Toussaint by the boys and the priest, hoping that the defeats and defections would have cowed Toussaint, and that fatherly affection would do the rest. All along the road, the crowds, glad to see the general's children back from Paris, came out to welcome them, shouted greetings, embraced them while they told of their messages of goodwill. Unknown to themselves, they were breaking down the spirit of resistance of the people. Toussaint was away, but late on the evening of the next day he came hurrying in. The boys threw themselves into his arms while tears streamed down the cheeks of the stern old soldier. Quesnon had hitherto kept himself carefully in the background, but, it is his own account, judging the moment ripe, he stepped forward with a solemn reminder of duty to France and produced the letter. The whole elaborate deception was a miserable failure. Toussaint, how well he knew these men, did not even bother to read the whole of the letter. He looked at half of it and was about to speak when Quesnon began a long eulogy of Bonaparte, his kindly reception of the boys, the peaceful nature of the expedition, etc. Dessalines would in all probability have shot Quesnon out of hand and taken his sons. But Toussaint was a different type. To Quesnon, he made a dignified response. Bonaparte's words announced peace. Leclerc's actions declared war.
In the midst of so many disasters and acts of violence, I must not forget that I wear a sword.
If Leclerc desired peace, let him stop the march of his army. They talked far into the night, and Toussaint could not contain his indignation as he understood that his sons were being offered to him as the price of his surrender. Yet that night, with the tears again flowing, he told the priest that while he was prepared to sacrifice his life for the freedom of the blacks, he would send the boys back lest Leclerc should think he was keeping them by coercion or undue influence. 2 days later, the letter for Leclerc was ready, and he sent it back with the boys, proposing a suspension of hostilities. Leclerc sent Isaac and Placide back again, promising that if Toussaint only came to discuss with him, all would be well. He would appoint Toussaint his first lieutenant. If not, after 4 days, he would declare Toussaint an outlaw. What he really wanted was to get Toussaint into his hands. Isaac and Placide entreated Toussaint to see Leclerc. He refused. What were Rigaud, Pétion, Villat, Chanlat, his personal enemies, doing in the French army? If, now that the blacks had some power, the French treated them in that way, how would they treat them when they were powerless? But moved by the entreaties of the boys and their obvious love for France, he told them he would not attempt to influence them. France or San Domingo.
My children, make your choice. Whatever it is, I shall always love you.
His own son Isaac declared for France, but Placide threw himself on his father, sobbing that he feared the future, feared slavery, and would fight with him. At once, Toussaint gave him command of a battalion of his guards, which he led into battle a few days later. Madame Louverture, with a woman's instinctive sense of immediate reality, would not give up Isaac and made him stay. Luckily for this narrative, we have the complete series of letters written by Leclerc from San Domingo to Bonaparte, the First Consul, and the Minister of Marine. For the student of any period of history, but particularly of imperialism, they are documents of priceless value.
I have great need of the reinforcements. You must see how difficult it is. I have already 600 sick, the majority of my troops having embarked 5 months ago. Cultivation is in good condition. Above all, count on my devotion. Many of those who envied my command in Paris would be wiped out here. I shall prove to France that you have made a good choice. 3 months before our arrival, Moise had sought to supplant Toussaint, and to do this, he had begun the massacre of 600 to 700 whites. Toussaint had him shot and has rid us of him. Toussaint has sent to make me proposals for the suspension of hostilities. I believe not a word of it. He is the most false and deceitful man in the world. I have already more than 1,200 men in hospital. Calculate on a considerable waste of life in this country. I am here without food or money. The burning of Le Cap and the districts through which the rebels have retired deprives me of all resources of this kind. It is necessary that the government send me provisions, money, troops. That is the only means of ensuring the preservation of San Domingo. I have here no resources in commerce. The traders at Le Cap are only the agents of the Americans, and the Americans are of all Jews the most Jewish. Leclerc had been merely playing with Toussaint. When his reinforcements arrived, he issued a proclamation putting Toussaint and Christophe outside the law, and prepared to overwhelm them in the plain of Gonaïves. Desfourneaux would leave the River Salé, and passing by way of Limbé and Plaisance, arrive at Gonaïves. Hardy would leave Le Cap, and by way of Marmelade and Ennery, descend on Gonaïves. Rochambeau would leave Fort Dauphin, and by way of Saint-Raphaël arrive at Gonaïves. Humbert and de Belle would defeat Maurepas and drive him back on Gonaïves, while Boudet, coming up from Port Republicain, would cut off the retreat and stab Toussaint's forces in the back. Toussaint, with half his 18,000 troops in the ranks of the enemy, could only delay and harass the advance, devastate the country, and deprive Leclerc of supplies while retiring slowly to the mountains. He was too good a soldier to attempt to defend every possible point where Leclerc might land, and had secreted his munitions and stores in strategic places, whence they could feed as many lines of retreat as possible. He would raid Leclerc's outposts, make surprise attacks, lay ambushes, give the French no peace while avoiding major engagements. With the coming of the rains, the French, worn out, would fall victims in thousands to the fever, and the blacks would descend and drive them into the sea. But first, he had to extricate himself from the steel ring that Leclerc was drawing round him. It is necessary to describe this campaign in some detail. The political maneuvers were based on the progress of the war, and the war was the supreme test of the people of San Domingo. Bonaparte's army did not fall from the sky, nor were his soldiers entirely the product of his own unparalleled genius for military command. They were, in the last analysis, the result, one of the finest results, of the revolutionary change in French society. Their irresistible élan, their intelligence, their endurance and morale sprang from the new social freedom that followed the destruction of feudalism. Their consciousness that they, the people, had done it. Their faith in themselves as the bearers of liberty and equality all over Europe. None of the French rank and file in San Domingo guessed that they were fighting to restore slavery. The war was, for them, a revolutionary war. But Toussaint's soldiers and generals, illiterates and ex-slaves, had been molded by the same revolution. An army is a miniature of the society which produces it. If the Black Army had wobbled before the French, it was because San Domingo society as a whole did not know what to think of Leclerc's expedition, could not believe its vile purpose. But the few thousand who remained faithful to Toussaint were the advance guard of the Revolutionary Army fighting a revolutionary war. They were, for the moment, outnumbered. If Toussaint had the help of some of the laborers, thousands of mulattoes and the former free were joining Leclerc. But the liberty and equality which these blacks acclaimed as they went into battle meant far more to them than the same words in the mouths of the French. And in a revolutionary struggle, These things are worth many regiments. Hardy, coming from Le Cap, met Christophe at Boispin on February 19th. Hardy drove Christophe from his position, but here the French received the first shock. Christophe, defeated, retired in good order and took up position at Ennery. On February 21st, Hardy attacked with a Napoleonic vigor that had swept and would sweep everything in Europe before it, until the army was mortally stricken in the Moscow campaign. Once again, Christophe was dislodged. But still holding his men together, he took up position again at Bayonnais. The next day, Hardy drove him back, but as signally, failed to disrupt his forces. Still covering the town of Gonaïves, Christophe now took up position at La Cour à Pintade, ready to meet the French the next day, the 23rd. Toussaint was at Gonaïves. He did not approve of all this fighting. He preferred guerrilla warfare and the raising of the population, but those who remained faithful to him were eager to cross swords with Bonaparte's soldiers, and Toussaint had to follow. Plaisance was treacherously surrendered to Rochambeau, and Toussaint, with 600 men and a few hundred auxiliaries, hastened to bar Rochambeau's way at Ravine à Couleuvre. It was a moment of great personal anxiety. His wife and family, hiding in a retreat in the mountains, had had to leave it, and Toussaint did not know where they were. But he prepared for battle with his usual disregard of his personal fate. Accompanied only by an aide and two laborers, he reconnoitered with such daring that one of his guides who pushed on too far was captured by an outpost and immediately killed. Toussaint, going back, addressed his army. "You are going to fight against men who have neither faith, law, nor religion. They promise you liberty. They intend your servitude. Why have so many ships traversed the ocean, if not to throw you again into chains? They disdain to recognize in you submissive children, and if you are not their slaves, you are rebels. The mother country, misled by the consul, is no longer anything for you but a stepmother. Uncover your breasts. You will see them branded by the iron of slavery. During 10 years, what have you not undertaken for liberty? Your masters slain or put to flight, the English humiliated by defeat. Discord extinguished, a land of slavery purified by fire and evolving more beautiful than ever under liberty. These are your labors, and these the fruits of your labors. And the foe wishes to snatch both out of your hands." He who had fought so hard to build spoke with fierce pride of the destruction which met the French on every side. The French would meet their fate. "Their bones will be scattered among these mountains and rocks and tossed about by the waves of the sea. Never more will they behold their native land, and liberty will reign over their tomb." But never a word of independence. Rochambeau, full of racial pride, thought it best to recall to his men their victories on the Tiber, the Nile, and the Rhine. They had not come thousands of miles to be defeated by slaves. At daybreak, the battle began. It was the fiercest battle of the war. Over and over again, Toussaint charged at the head of his men. During the day, he learned that his wife and family were hiding not far from the battle.
"See that they take the road to Esther," he told his informant. "I have my duty to perform."
Men threw away their arms and grappled for life and death. At last, late in the afternoon, Toussaint put himself at the head of his grenadiers, with a final attack drove Rochambeau over the river, and then returned to his side of the stream. Both sides claimed the victory, and have continued to do so to this day. Christophe had on the same day been driven back by Hardy from La Cour à Pintade, and Hardy with Leclerc marched into the town of Gonaïves. The other appointees to the rendezvous were absent. Neither Humbert from the north nor Boudet from the south had arrived to complete the encircling movement. Their failure was due to events which are of the first importance,
actual and symptomatic. Humbert, with 1,500 men, left Port-de-Paix and attacked Maurepas with 2,000 men and an auxiliary corps of laborers, intending to roll him down into the plain of Gonaïves. But Maurepas beat off his attack and pursued him into the town so hotly that he would have had to embark but for a timely reinforcement sent from a warship in the harbor. On learning this, Leclerc ordered de Belle from Le Cap with another 1,500 men to join Hardy, dislodge Maurepas, and drive him toward Gonaïves. Both of them now attacked. Maurepas beat the two of them and once more chased them into the town, which, but for the fleet, would again have fallen into his hands. Leclerc could no longer deal with Christophe and Toussaint. He had to send Hardy and de Fourneau to the rescue of Humbert and de Belle. Equally disastrous to Leclerc's plans had been the work of Dessalines in the south. His bold conception of a return march on Port Republicain and the speed with which he executed it were too much for the French. Luck, and astonishing luck alone, saved them, as Lacroix, in command at Port Republicain, has himself admitted. In the West Province were two bands of Maroons, one of them led by Lamour d'Errance, a name destined to become famous in this War of Independence. Black though they were, they had been partisans of Rigaud, and still more hated Dessalines, because as commander of the district, he had half destroyed their forces for raiding and for practicing voodoo, strictly forbidden by Toussaint. They, from their mountain fastnesses, now saw Dessalines approaching and guessed his aim. They hastened to warn the French at Port Republicain and offered their submission and alliance. French and Creoles were alike astonished. Lacroix accepted gladly. An ambush was laid, and Dessalines' advance guard of 1,000 men was destroyed at a stroke. Dessalines' plan of surprise was ruined, but he nevertheless marched on the city. Feeling his way by a preliminary skirmish, he found it well prepared, and therefore decided to retire. Boudet had followed him from Saint-Marc, but uncertain as to what this demoniacal black general would do next, and utterly exhausted, he stayed at Port Republicain, while Dessalines and Lamartinière set off northwards to make contact with Toussaint. Leclerc's first attempt had failed completely. Toussaint, Christophe, and Dessalines had their forces intact, held the internal lines of communication, and were in touch with each other. It is this first phase of the campaign which revealed the strength and skill of the local army. Of Toussaint's generals, only two carried out an immediate and uncompromising resistance to the French. They were Maurepas and Dessalines. Both their campaigns were brilliantly successful. Had he dismissed Agé, put Lamartinière in charge at Port Republicain, with orders to get rid of traitors, primed his brother Paul for resistance, placed Belair and others whom he could trust in key positions, and had Moïse to raise the laborers on the North Plain as in the old days, the French would never have been able to capture all the coast towns, and would have been in immense difficulty to hold those they might take. Equally important is the fact that, as Leclerc himself early recognized, victories on one side or the other would draw the waverers. Under a strong impulse from the Black Army and the Black laborers, the defection of men like Le Plume and Clairvaux was unlikely. Between the alien Leclerc on the one hand, and the masses and the bulk of the army united under Toussaint on the other, they would probably have remained. In every revolution, there are many who hesitate, and though decisive action may not be immediately effective, vacillation is certain to lose them all. Yet, denuded as it was, the remains of the army had done its work in the first shock. The rainy season would soon be coming. Leclerc had to get the black generals in his power, and that seemed as far off as ever. But here another stroke of luck befell him. Maurepas, victorious over de Belle and Humbert, understood that Leclerc would now send more detachments to overwhelm him, and he prepared to evacuate his position and make contact with Toussaint and Christophe. In addition to Maurepas's known education and character, he had under him the crack regiment of San Domingo, the 9th Brigade, of which all San Domingo boasted that it never surrendered. But De Fourneau had lived and fought under Toussaint in San Domingo, with the black soldiers. And while Leclerc's armies were attacking, De Fourneau was writing letters like these. "You know me, Commandant André, and you know that no one has worked harder for your liberty than I. You were a captain under me 5 years ago, and you have always conducted yourself well. The Commander-in-Chief instructs me to tell you that you will be maintained in your command if you decide to come to me and join us in restoring order and tranquility in your country. If you agree, send me someone to fix things at once. I have never broken my word. You can count on me." De Fourneau asked another of Toussaint's officers to denounce the abominable slanders that the rebels were spreading about the intentions of the government. "You know me. I would not serve in this army if its operation had any other aim than to consolidate your liberty and safeguard your persons and your property." Was De Fourneau sincere? The question is irrelevant. It was Leclerc's decisions that mattered. And even if De Fourneau was sincere, when Leclerc unmasked himself, De Fourneau was not going to join the men he had deceived. But such appeals were powerful. If the French had come merely to restore French authority, what was the use of this war? Toussaint even then had not declared independence and had never made any clear governmental pronouncement about Leclerc's intention to restore slavery. Their correspondence proves that some of these officers revolted at the relentless command to burn and ravage the country yet once more. Guibert, holding the key position of Gros Morne, surrendered. And then, one by one, as each realized the difficulties previous defections put him in, a line of commandants submitted to the French. They were welcomed and confirmed in their commands. Thus, Maurepas found himself cut off. He cursed his treacherous subordinates, told them that they wanted to become slaves again. "If they wanted to go," said Maurepas, "they could at least have told him, so that he could withdraw his own forces in time." Obviously, these officers did not want to be slaves again, and the struggle still seemed a question of taking which side you wanted. Maurepas could now stay and be annihilated, or join the French and retain his command. He surrendered. Leclerc welcomed him warmly, as well he might. The masses in the north were moving, but the surrender of Maurepas stopped the growth and the development of the new movement of insurrection that Boyer and Rear Admiral Magon could scarcely restrain, with the soldiers of the artillery and of the fleet with which they were reinforced. The vacillation of the leaders was killing the revolutionary ardor of the people at every turn. "It was to the moral effect produced by the surrender of Maurepas," continues Lacroix, "that the Captain General Leclerc owed the possibility of pursuing the revolt of Toussaint Louverture to its last hiding place. Worse still, to prove his loyalty, Maurepas was set to clear the country of the brigands. In other words, the revolting masses. That was now his duty. Leclerc carefully surrounded him with white troops, and Maurepas had no choice. To weaken him, Leclerc distributed numbers of his men in other regiments so that the masses saw themselves hunted down and rounded up by white troops aided by the men whom they had hitherto looked upon as their staunchest defenders. Morally and materially strengthened, Leclerc now began another movement which should converge on Toussaint, Christophe, and Dessalines at Verrette instead of Gonaïves. Maurepas, instead of a victorious enemy, was an ally, and Boudet, refreshed, was on the way from Port Republican. Leclerc was becoming anxious. "I am master of the north, but almost all of it has been burnt, and I can expect no resources from it. there are laborers assembled and armed in 20 spots. The rebels are still masters of a part of the West, and they have burnt the positions they no longer hold. For the present, I can expect no supplies from there. The government must not think of the money it is spending to ensure the finest colony in the world and preserve those it possesses in the Antilles, for it is here at this moment that is being decided the question of knowing whether Europe will preserve any colonies in the Antilles.
Near to Petite Riviere, in the interior, is the fortress of Crête-à-Pierrot, commanding the entrance to the mountainous Cahos regions where Toussaint was reserving his forces for the moment. It is not of great natural strength, being on ground rising to no more than a height of 300 feet, but it was strongly fortified. In the confusion which followed the early successes of the French, the blacks had abandoned it, and Dessalines with La Martinière, marching north from Port Republican, was about to raise it to the ground when Toussaint stopped him. Toussaint had shaken off Rochambeau after the Battle of Ravine à Courlieuve. He threw out a light curtain of troops in front of Rochambeau, the French general followed them, and they led him in a great circle over the Grand Cahos Mountains, to disappear altogether after days of pursuit. Toussaint, meanwhile, drew off his main forces and arrived just in time to meet Dessalines and place a new plan before his generals. Burning with fever, outnumbered and surrounded, he was about to attempt the most audacious stroke of the war, a new offensive, and therefore wanted Crête-à-Pierrot held. He entrusted it to Dessalines. The men with him now could be depended on never to submit to the French, and were following him partly out of political conviction, partly out of personal loyalty. There were mulattoes and blacks among them, but he spoke to them all as his children.
"Yes, you are all my children. From La Martinière, who is white as white, but who knows that he has Negro blood in his veins, to Montpoint, whose skin is the same as mine. I entrust to you this post."
They replied that he could rely on them living or dead, and at the head of a few hundred soldiers, Toussaint set out for the north. He would get through Leclerc's advancing forces, raise and organize the laborers, and by threatening or cutting the long French line of communications with Le Cap, make Leclerc alter his plans or throw his forces into confusion. 12 years later, Napoleon, in the greatest of all his campaigns, the campaign of 1814, would attempt the identical maneuver in face of the Allies swarming on Paris. Dessalines undertook the defense. He threw up a redoubt at some distance from Crête-à-Pierrot, left detachments to man them both, and went to meet Debelle, who was coming south toward Verrettes to make contact with Boudet. Dessalines would not give battle, but retired toward Crête-à-Pierrot, keeping his forces just ahead of the hotly pursuing Debelle. As he reached the ditch which surrounded the fortress, Dessalines jumped into it, and all his men followed, leaving the French exposed. A withering fire from the fortress mowed them down. 400 fell, and 2 generals were wounded. Hastily retreating, they took up position outside the fortress and sent to Leclerc for reinforcements. Dessalines entered the fortress and completed the preparations for the defense. But already his untutored mind had leapt forward to the only solution, and, unlike Toussaint, he was taking his men into his confidence. As they prepared the defense, he talked to them.
"Take courage, I tell you, take courage. The French will not be able to remain long in San Domingo. They will do well at first, but soon they will fall ill and die like flies. Listen, if Dessalines surrenders to them 100 times, he will deceive them 100 times. I repeat, take courage, and you will see that when the French are few, we shall harass them, we shall beat them, we shall burn the harvests and retire to the mountains. They will not be able to guard the country, and they will have to leave. Then I shall make you independent. There will be no more whites among us."
Independence. It was the first time that a leader had put it before his men. Here was not only a program, but tactics. The lying and treacherous Bonaparte and Leclerc had met their match at last. While Dessalines remained in Crêta-Pierrot, La Martinière took command of the redoubt. His wife, Marie-Jeanne, had joined him and took her share in the defense. Dessalines, naked to the waist with dirty boots, a hole in his hat where a bullet had passed through, patrolled the ramparts, glasses in hand. He had thrown small detachments of scouts right round the fortress, awaiting the approach of the French reinforcements. Getting the news from de Belle, Leclerc knew that Crêta-Pierrot had to be taken as quickly as possible, and ordered a concentration there of all his forces. Boudet arrived first. Dessalines, on the ramparts, placed a barrel of powder next to where he stood, and with a lighted torch in his hand, invited those of the garrison who wished to become slaves of the French to leave. "We are going to be attacked. If the French put their feet in here, I shall blow everything up." With one voice, the garrison replied, "We shall die for liberty." Boudet sent a herald to the fortress, but Dessalines wanted no lying messages and shot him down, whereupon Boudet engaged one of the outposts. The blacks retreated before him until they reached the ditch. Then they jumped in, and a terrific fire of artillery and musketry cut the French to pieces. The French broke. Boudet was wounded, and Lacroix gave the command to retreat, leaving the ground covered with dead and wounded. As these retired, Dugua, chief of staff, accompanied by Leclerc, arrived with his division and led his troops at the fortress. They reached the ditches, and the relentless fire from Dessalines' artillery was too much for them. They wavered, and seeing them waver, the garrison, uttering loud hurrahs, threw planks across the ditch, and, drums beating the attack, pursued the retreating Frenchmen. These turned back and charged with the bayonet. The blacks appeared to fly before them, but it was only to jump into the ditches again when the fire from the fortress decimated the French ranks. Dugois fell wounded in two places. Leclerc was slightly wounded, and the French that day lost nearly 800 men. Some days after came Rochambeau. Having lost Toussaint, he arrived with his forces fresh and ready for battle. He was warned of the two previous disasters, but having silenced the fire of La Martinière's redoubt by an intensive bombardment, he attacked it, leading his division in person. He was beaten back, was himself wounded, and his division lost 300 men. The French had thus lost 1,500 men outside Crêta-Pierrot. 12,000 of them under Leclerc now encircled the 1,200 men in the fortress. Dessalines had left to raise the laborers on the countryside, but the garrison gave him their word not to surrender. Fired by the determination and courage of their leader, the besieged ran up the red flag at the four corners of the fortress, intimating that they were neither giving nor taking quarter. The black garrison, beating off assaults and hurling defiance at 10 times its number. Toussaint, traveling swiftly northward to cut Leclerc's communications. Bonaparte's periods were in a tangle, and Leclerc was getting very, very anxious. It was now halfway through March, and the rainy season was almost there. Feverishly, Leclerc set his men to fortify their positions. Pétion was in the besieging army with a corps of mulattoes and former free, and it was Pétion who devised ways and means of investing the fortress by the use of local material. But their hard fighting and labors in this strange and unaccustomed climate wore down the French soldiers. This was not the way they had conquered in Italy, in Egypt, in the Pyrenees, and on the Rhine. Dessalines, raiding their lines from the neighboring hills, kept them constantly on the alert. By subjecting them to this unceasing strain, they would fall easy victims to the fever in the rainy season. And these blacks were bewildering enemies. They had the organization and discipline of a trained army, and at the same time, all the tricks and dodges of guerrillas. A black appeared among Boudet's soldiers, claiming to be a deserter. As Boudet, in the midst of his guard, questioned him, he seemed overwhelmed with fear. but he was a scout, and having learned all he wanted to know, he made a dash for safety. Mude, who saw his movement first, tried to stop him, but the black nearly bit off his thumb. Then, dashing beneath the legs of a horse, he overthrew the soldiers who tried to stop him, plunged into the river, and escaped amid a shower of bullets. He was struck, for on the opposite bank he collapsed, but a party of his own people carried him off. Dessalines' relentless murders of all whites were having their effect. The French soldiers were retaliating, and Leclerc and his generals were shooting their prisoners, hundreds of blacks at a time, 600 at one shooting. The black laborers, though not leaping to the attack, were hostile to the invading whites. They watched their movements from a distance and fired at their flanks. If the French dispatched a body of men to disperse them, they fled. As soon as these rejoined the main body, the laborers reappeared again. It was evident that we no longer inspired moral terror, and it is the greatest misfortune that can befall an army. Lacroix could see the effect on the population of this indomitable challenge to the famous army of the First Consul. The dishonest political position of the French army was now taking its toll. The soldiers still thought of themselves as a revolutionary army. Yet at nights, they heard the blacks in the fortress singing the Marseillaise, the Ça Ira, and the other revolutionary songs. Lacroix records how these misguided wretches, as they heard the songs, started and looked at the officers as if to say, "Have our barbarous enemies justice on their side? Are we no longer the soldiers of Republican France? And have we become the crude instruments of policy?" A regiment of Poles, remembering their own struggle for nationalism, refused to join in the massacre of 600 blacks ordered by Leclerc, and later, when Dessalines was reorganizing the local army, he would call one of his regiments the Polish Regiment. Toussaint had no mercy on the local whites, but he treated the French prisoners with courtesy and care, spoke frequently to them, explained his stand. Later, as the army went to pieces, some soldiers deserted to the blacks. All that was needed was a highly political detachment of white Jacobins fighting in the black ranks and calling on Leclerc's soldiers to come over. But the garrison had neither doubts nor scruples. Being without water, they kept in their mouths balls of lead in order to quench an insupportable thirst. Nobody complained. The officers asked the chief of ambulance for doses of poison to prevent them falling alive into the hands of the French, and the wounded asked their companions in case of evacuation to kill them before they left. The French, well supplied with artillery, began a 3 days bombardment, intending to beat the fortress and the redoubt to dust, and their black and mulatto allies were a mighty support. Pétion's skill in artillery threw cannonball after cannonball into the fortress. When his men complained of always being put in the front, he rebuked them. "Wretches," he said in a low voice, as if ashamed that the French should hear, "are you not honored to be placed first? Be quiet and follow me." Lacroix asked Baudin, that valorous Negro, to hold a pontoon. "Do not worry, General," was the reply. "They will take it when I am dead." Nervous for another in a difficult position, Lacroix told him to be of good cheer.
"Do not be worried, General," replied Ina. 10 years now I have cheerfully made war for the Republic. Why should I not do it for a quarter of an hour for friendship?"
It would have been difficult enough in any circumstances to tear the epaulets from the shoulders of these niggers, both majors, but it would be trebly so after the services they were rendering with such gallant, even debonair, loyalty. Every day of war was piling up mountains in the way of Bonaparte's clear and precise instructions. Toussaint had started with little over 1,000 men. But as he went along, he raised the laborers, and at the sight of him and the sound of his great voice, they came. He appeared before Ennery, and the garrison fled. Leclerc sent Hardy to follow him. Toussaint threw out his curtain of troops, which led Hardy in the wrong direction, made him describe a circle, and at the end remain like Rochambeau with no troops to fight against. He commanded Christophe, who was in the mountainous districts of Petite Rivière, to go to the Grande Rivière in the north and keep the road to Le Cap and the Spanish part of the island open. In Marmelade, Grande Rivière, Dondon, Sanssouci, Port Français, his own northern districts whose spirit he had so ruthlessly broken, the laborers were massing now. One of his adherents held the mountains of Limbé, another the mountains around Plaisance. Desfourneaux held Plaisance itself, guarding Leclerc's communications with Le Cap. If Toussaint took Plaisance, he would join hands with Christophe and Maurepas, raise the whole of the North Plain, capture Le Cap, and then, with his authority restored in the north, take Leclerc in the rear. He launched the first attack on the Fort Bédarède, as usual leading the charge with sword drawn. While the battle raged, Desfourneaux, from Plaisance, sent reinforcements, and Toussaint himself went to meet these. To his amazement, he saw advancing against him soldiers wearing the uniform of the 9th Brigade, the crack corps under the command of Maurepas. He recognized at once what had happened. Riding out alone to within 5 or 6 paces of the regiment, he spoke to them.
Soldiers of the 9th, will you dare to fire on your general, your fathers and your brothers?
The black soldiers fell on their knees before him, and he would have won them back. But the Europeans with them fired on Toussaint. His own soldiers rushed up to protect him. At that moment, a young officer handed Toussaint a letter from Dessalines and was immediately shot, dying in Toussaint's arms. The captain of Toussaint's dragoons was grievously wounded at his side, and holding the wounded man on his horse, Toussaint galloped away. Dessalines' letter told him that Crête à Pierrot and the redoubt were completely invested with such large forces that he could not relieve them. He abandoned the project of marching on Le Cap and sent to tell Dessalines that he was returning to relieve the fortress. But Dessalines could not wait. On March 24th, the third day of the bombardment, the French captured a black man and a black woman. The man said he was blind, only the whites of his eyes could be seen and he could scarcely walk, while the old black woman with him said that she was deaf. Suspecting them to be spies, the French beat them mercilessly. But they only sobbed and wailed, said nothing, and lay as if unable to move. Lacroix, on his rounds, took pity on them and asked that they should be allowed to go about their business. But not until the French threatened to shoot them did they get up and walk. As soon as they were out of reach, they began to dance and ran to the fortress to give Dessalines order to evacuate. At nightfall, Lamartinière left the redoubt and joined the main force. There were only 800 of them now, but they were going to make the attempt to cut their way through. Magny was Lamartinière's superior officer, but in moments of crisis, it is merit that counts, and by common consent, Lamartinière took command. Between 8 and 9 in the evening, the men of the garrison threw themselves on the Croix's division. Strong fortifications and fierce gunfire stopped them. Suddenly reversing their tactics, they retreated and attacked the division of Rochambeau. They broke through. Rochambeau fled into a neighboring wood to save his life, and Lamartinière and Magny, with 700 men, rejoined Dessalines, having accomplished one of the most remarkable feats of arms of the period. Toussaint reached the fortress just too late and did not know that the evacuation had taken place. Reconnoitering, he detected a weakness in the disposition of Leclerc's forces, and he planned to raid that general's headquarters and arrest him with the whole of his staff. He was as daring and as tireless as ever, but his politics still lagged behind events. If he had captured Leclerc and his staff, he was going to send them back to France with an account of Leclerc's conduct and ask the First Consul to send someone worthy of confidence to whom he might hand over the government. He seemed still to be hoping that if he defeated Leclerc, Bonaparte would see reason and the valuable connection with France be maintained. But the days for that were over. Dessalines had pronounced the word independence. Magny and Lamartinière and the garrison of Crête-à-Pierrot had defied not Leclerc, but France. Toussaint was still thinking in terms of the decree of February 4, 1794. The Black Revolution had passed him by. The capture of Crête-à-Pierrot was a great victory for Leclerc, but a victory that had cost too much. The garrison had escaped with a loss of less than half its men. Leclerc had lost 2,000 dead. Several of his officers were severely wounded. Duguay was to die. And he entered the fortress to find only the wounded, the cannon spiked, the war material and stores destroyed. Leclerc begged his officers to moderate the casualties in their reports. But even as it was, Bonaparte was profoundly moved by the disastrous losses before Crête-à-Pierrot and sent to say so. Leclerc sent Rochambeau and Hardy northwards to maintain and strengthen his communications with Le Cap. He asked Lacroix to enter Port Républicain in such a way as to efface the bad impression which had been created in the population by the repeated checks all over the country and the losses in front of Crête-à-Pierrot. Lacroix placed his men in two ranks instead of three. The sections marched at great distances from each other, and all the officers were mounted. He had artillery harnessed to animals sent to meet him. He distributed these among his columns, and by this careful window dressing made the moral effect which he intended in Port Républicain, or at any rate, thought he did. With the fall of Crête-à-Pierrot, Leclerc believed that he no longer needed to keep on good terms with the mulattoes. Anxious to carry out some at least of Bonaparte's instructions, he had Rigaud and his family arrested and sent back to France. Some trifling excuse was given as the pretext, but this deceived no one. When Rigaud went on board and an officer announced to him that he was a prisoner and demanded his sword, with a movement of indignation, he threw it into the sea. An involuntary acknowledgement of the colossal fool he had made of himself in deserting Toussaint for Edouville. On arriving in France, he would be imprisoned. Rigaud gone, the leader of the mulattoes was now Pétion. He, it seems, had heard nothing of Rigaud's deportation until he read the notice affixed to the door of Lacroix's house in Port Républicain. Then, it seems, for the first time, Pétion understood what old Toussaint had understood so many years before. Madagascar, or its French equivalent, was still a possibility. Pétion was, like Toussaint, a noticeably quiet man, but on reading the notice he said, loud enough to be heard by French officers, "It was well worth the trouble to make him come here and give him as well as us this disappointment." It was the beginning of mulatto wisdom. Toussaint had only regret for the misguided Rigaud. "It was against me that they brought the general here. It is not for me that they are deporting him. I regret his fate." Why did he not seek contact with Pétion and propose to him a pact of independence? The arrest of Rigaud, their leader, had startled all the mulattoes. But Toussaint, even while he was harrying Leclerc, was secretly seeking means of coming to a compromise with him, a compromise that Leclerc would soon be glad to accept. But Leclerc now once more had hopes of easy victory. On April 5th, reinforcements of 2,500 men arrived at Le Cap, and he changed his tactics. He would attack the black leaders singly in their mountain fastnesses, with some of the fresh troops and well-sandwiched detachments of Toussaint's old soldiers. If he could not destroy them at a stroke, he would do it piecemeal. Hardy, therefore, attempted to drive Christophe from Dondon, but Christophe chased him back into Le Cap, taking revenge for the earlier defeats at Hardy's hands. Boyer attacked Sanssouci, holding the fortresses of Saint-Suzanne and the districts around. The blacks in Boyer's force deserted, and Sans Souci made prisoners of all the whites who were not killed. Close attacked Marmalade. The blacks drove him off, making numerous prisoners. To read English and French accounts of their operations in San Domingo, one would believe that, but for yellow fever, they would have been easily victorious. But up to April, there had been no yellow fever. Toussaint had lost more than half his forces even before the campaign began. Leclerc had raised thousands of black troops, and some of Toussaint's troops had fought with him. Yet in the 8 weeks of February and March, 17,000 French veterans had landed. 5,000 were in hospital, 5,000 were dead, and the first period was not yet complete. The war to the death, and the hunting down of the black generals who would not present themselves to be deported, was a total failure.
The rainy season has arrived. My troops are exhausted with fatigue and sickness. The districts of Grand Rivière, Dondon, Marmalade, are unpracticable in this rainy season. I could hold them only with a corps of 4,000 to 5,000 men. It would not be possible to feed them. I have tried several times to make Toussaint and all the generals surrender. But even though, citizen minister, I should succeed in making these men submit, I would not be able to adopt those rigorous measures which are needed to assure to France the undisputed possession of San Domingo until I have 25,000 Europeans present under arms. I have pointed out to you, citizen minister, the difficulties of my present position. You can easily judge what would happen if war broke out with the English. They would infect our coasts. They would lose no opportunity to cut my communications by sea and by attacking and blockading the Mole. They would furnish assistance to the insurgents, who in their turn would acquire a new preponderance and who, from their present defensive, would seek to take the offensive. Leclerc was in a situation even worse than his letter revealed. It was already late April. The rainy season was beginning, and Toussaint was powerfully placed. In the north, fired by Toussaint's audacious march, the blacks were now swarming out and reinforcing the regular army by guerrilla methods. They were attacking the French columns on all sides, without respite, disappearing suddenly, only to reappear a few miles further on. They hung enormous stones over the roads and dropped them onto the French passing below, rolled rocks down the precipices and mountainsides to spread confusion among them. They dug precipices in the roads and covered them with branches, and the French horsemen fell into them. They blockaded the paths with thorny bushes and trees. And while the French struggled through these obstacles, from neighboring trees, shrubs, and carefully chosen eminences, they picked them off at leisure. Makaya at Limbe, Sila in the mountains of Plaisance, Sanssouci at Saint-Suzanne and Vallières, Dessalines at Marchand in the Artibonite, Charles Belair at Calvaire and Plassac, not far from Crête-à-Pierrot, holding the entry to the Grand Cahos Mountains. All these generals and partisans were absolutely devoted to Toussaint, inexpugnable from their positions and ready to fight the French to the death. The indefatigable Toussaint was not waiting on the British, and was at that moment preparing the very offensive which Leclerc dreaded. He planned to swoop down on the French at four points: Dessalines to take Marmalade, Belair to join him and both to attack Crête-à-Pierrot, Vernet, a mulatto who had remained faithful, to take Gonaïves, and Toussaint himself to take Plaisance and Limbe. But Toussaint from the start looked on this war as a disaster. He wanted to come to terms with Leclerc. And now Leclerc, sadly fallen from his high hopes of the arrest and deportation of the black generals, was anxious to come to terms himself. Instead of repudiating the French, seeking contact with the mulattoes, some of whom had remained with his army, and calling on all to fight for freedom, the property of the whites, and independence, Toussaint now wrote a reply to Bonaparte's letter and sent it to Boudet. He assured Bonaparte of his devotion and submission to his orders, and affected to believe that Leclerc had acted in opposition to Bonaparte's instructions. If Bonaparte would send another general to take command of the colony, all would be well. If not, by his continued resistance, Toussaint would only be assisting Leclerc in doing all the evil possible. By this offer, he gave Bonaparte the opportunity to withdraw from a hopeless expedition with dignity and send someone else to negotiate with Toussaint for the new relation with France which Toussaint wanted. At the same time, Toussaint, by his new offensive on all points, would strike terror into the hearts of Leclerc and the French and force them to a truce. It was magnificent diplomacy, but ruinous as a revolutionary policy. The slopes to treachery from the dizzy heights of revolutionary leadership are always so steep and slippery that leaders, however well-intentioned, can never build their fences too high. Toussaint gave Christophe permission to negotiate with Leclerc and was reading Leclerc's letters to Christophe and supervising Christophe's replies. Leclerc proposed to Christophe to seize Toussaint. Christophe indignantly rejected the treachery. Leclerc understood that he had gone too far and proposed an interview with Christophe. Toussaint told Christophe to go and hear what Leclerc had to say. Christophe went. Leclerc assured him of his good faith, promised to maintain him and all his officers in their commands, and Christophe submitted. It was a terrific blow to the revolution. When Toussaint and the others reproached him, Christophe, a man known to appreciate the comforts of life, replied that he was tired of living in the woods like a brigand. Christophe has been blamed, wrongly. The fault was entirely Toussaint's. His combination of fierce offensives with secret negotiations was too torturous a method for Christophe. It was a policy suited for war between two national states, not for a revolutionary war. True, the masses did not know of the negotiations, but it was the results that mattered. Christophe was an ex-slave, a man of the revolution, one of Toussaint's staunchest supporters. If he surrendered to the French, why should the black laborers go on fighting? Once more, the masses had received a shattering blow, not from the bullets of the enemy, but from where the masses most often receive it, from their own trembling leaders. With Christophe went 1,200 soldiers, 100 pieces of cannon, a quantity of ammunition, and 2,000 white inhabitants. Limbe and Port-Français passed into the hands of the French without a shot fired, and Marmalade was left open. But Leclerc was now thoroughly afraid of Toussaint and preferred to negotiate rather than to fight. Toussaint was not in any way depressed. He told Leclerc in one letter that the mischief he had done was evidence of the mischief he could do, and that he would sell dearly a life that had been at some time useful to the mother country. Leclerc was extremely conciliatory. He used Christophe as a go-between and informed Toussaint that it would be a wonderful day when he submitted himself to the orders of the Republic. Toussaint sent him 3 of the aides-de-camp and his secretary, and after a conference lasting several hours, submission was arranged on 3 conditions: indisputable liberty for all in San Domingo, maintenance in their grades and functions of all the native officers, Toussaint to keep his staff and retire where he wished on the territory of the colony. Bonaparte had stringently enjoined Leclerc not to leave any officer above the rank of captain on the island. Toussaint would submit only on the condition that every officer was maintained not only in his grade, but in his functions. How carefully the imperialists maintain the fiction about native troops being no good except under white officers. It was the trained army that Bonaparte wished to behead, and it was that army that Toussaint wanted to maintain. Despite the submission, the victory was still with Toussaint. He had an interview with Dessalines and Charles Belair, his nephew, and persuaded them to submit also. There was nothing else for them to do, and they agreed. Lamartiniere, Magne, and all the army joining the French. The whole French army was as glad as it was astonished at this sudden peace. Lacroix and another officer, Lemonnier de la Fosse, have testified to the relief of the French at this unlooked-for submission. Toussaint's strength was so obvious that even though they were ashamed to negotiate on these terms, they were glad to do so. Nor were their secret humiliations and fears reassured by the behavior of Toussaint. He never at any time acted like a defeated commander. Leclerc wrote him flattering letters and invited him to a meeting in Le Cap. Without warning Leclerc, Toussaint suddenly rode into the city on May 6th with his staff and a company of dragoons, accompanied by the French general Hardy. Some few hooted, and Toussaint said to Hardy,
"So men are everywhere. I have seen them at my foot, these men who are cursing me. But they will regret me soon."
They will regret me soon. What would Hardy think of this? But the great body of people in Le Cap came out to cheer him. They hailed him as the liberator. Mothers pointed him out to their children, and girls strewed flowers in his path. At Leclerc's headquarters, he drew up his dragoons in formation and went in with his aides de camp, the dragoons remaining in the courtyard with swords drawn. Toussaint had intended to enter Le Cap alone, but they refused to leave him. Leclerc's officers gave him a distinguished welcome and sent to call Leclerc, who was dining on board ship. He hastened back at once, and after giving Toussaint a salute, threw himself into his arms and asked him to come into his private office.
"General," he began, "we can only praise you and admire you for the way you have borne the burden of governing San Domingo."
Toussaint, stern and aloof, asked him why he had brought sword and fire to a peaceful country. Leclerc tried to make excuses. Toussaint did not accept them.
"I agree," said Leclerc, "but I was not master of myself. Let us forget the past and rejoice, General, at our reconciliation."
Contrary to his usual diplomatic manner, Toussaint, with the drawn swords of his guards outside, would not respond to Leclerc's overtures. He refused the post of lieutenant general. Paul Louverture came to greet him. Toussaint, who did not yet know of the confusion with the letters, repelled him before the whole company. Leclerc invited him to dinner, but although he accepted, he would not eat. Afraid of being poisoned, he drank only a glass of water, and near the end of the meal had a scrap of cheese, cut very carefully from the center of the piece that was offered to him. 2 days later, Leclerc asked him to dismiss his guard, and Toussaint bade them goodbye, asking them to submit to the new order. As they listened to him, Magny, the hero of Crêtepuro, in front, they wept at this sad ending to the great campaigns that had begun, when, from a horde of half-naked slaves, they had organized themselves into a little band to study war and fight for liberty. Toussaint was visibly moved, but he controlled himself. After embracing his chief officers, he took the road to his plantation at Ennery. As he drew near, the crowds came out to meet him.
"General," they asked, "have you abandoned us?"
"No, my children," he answered. "All your brothers are under arms, and the officers of all ranks retain their posts."
That was the issue. Would the blacks retain their army or not? A few days later, Dessalines entered Le Cap to make his formal submission. He also came with morale unbroken. French general officers were walking about in the streets. Nobody took any notice of them, but at the cry of "Dessalines," the whole population rushed to prostrate themselves before him. Lacroix saw this and understood what it meant. Noted, too, the boldness and assurance with which Dessalines spoke to him and the other Frenchmen. Dessalines and his division took service with Leclerc. Toussaint, glad that the destruction was over and having confidence in the army still intact, began with his usual energy to cultivate his plantations. Although he had no confidence in Leclerc at all, he thought himself safe for the moment. He would watch developments. At any crisis, he would be there. It was his ultimate confidence in the army and the people that led him to make his mistake. At the back of his mind, he knew that they could never be beaten. But his eyes fixed on the French, he did not know that he had lost the confidence of Dessalines, who was no longer looking to him for leadership, but was working out his own road to independence. Full of chagrin at his failure to carry out Bonaparte's instructions, Leclerc committed the error of writing false despatches home.
2 days later, General Toussaint sent his adjutant general with a letter signifying little, but in which I saw a very pronounced desire to surrender. I replied to this general that I would receive his submission, but that if he did not surrender promptly, I would march against him. That for the rest, he should send me one of his confidential servants to tell me what he desired. He sent his private secretary with one of his aides de camp, letting me know that he desired to have the rank of lieutenant general and a special command, that each of his generals should resume the command he had enjoyed at the time of my entry, and that he should have under his orders only his own troops. I replied to him that he would not be employed, that he would have to withdraw to one of his estates which he would be unable to leave without my permission, that the generals as well as the troops would be employed, but only when I judged it suitable, and it seemed to me advantageous. That as for him, he had only to surrender to me at Le Cap, that I gave my word of honor that he would be free to go where he wished after the conference. For the rest, that his troops must be all assembled and ready to carry out my orders in 4 days' time. If circumstances force me sometimes, citizen minister, to appear to deviate from the goal of my instructions, believe me, I do not lose sight of them, and I yield something to circumstances only to master them afterwards and to make them serve in the execution of my plan. As my reports, which you order to be printed, appear here in the newspapers, it is impolitic to insert anything in them which might destroy the ideas of liberty and equality which are on everybody's lips here. General Toussaint has surrendered here. He left perfectly satisfied with me and ready to carry out all my orders. I believe that he will carry them out because he is persuaded that if he did not, I would make him repent it. Sickness is causing frightful havoc in the army under my command. I have at this moment 3,600 men in hospital. For the last 15 days, I have been losing from 30 to 50 men a day in the colony, and no day passes without from 200 to 250 men entering the hospitals, while not more than 50 come out. My hospitals are overcrowded. To be master of San Domingo, I need 25,000 Europeans under arms. You see that I have only half that number. There is not a moment to lose in sending me reinforcements. For the rest, citizen minister, assure the First Consul that I have not for a moment lost sight of the direct instructions he had given me, as much from the political point of view as from the commercial, and that I shall consider it a happy day for me when the national commerce by itself will be capable of provisioning San Domingo and the French army. In this way must a colonial war result in the triumph of commerce. Here is a list of the chief persons whom death has taken off since my last dispatch. At the moment of writing, many generals or superior officers are sick. Of 16 persons who lived in General Hardy's house, 13 are dead. All General Ledoguin's secretaries are dead also. An association of traders in timber had been set up at Le Cap. This house comprised 7 persons. All 7 died within 8 days. I ordered the chief officer of health to draw up a report for me on this sickness. According to this report, it seems that this sickness is that which is called yellow fever, or Siamese disease. That this sickness reigns every year in the Antilles at the time of the passage of the sun in this hemisphere, but that it displays at Le Cap more intensity than is usual on account of the miasmas exhaled by the burnt houses. This sickness is heralded in some people by symptoms which are either slight pains or pains in the bowels or shivering. In others, the sickness affects them suddenly and kills within 2 days or 3. But of those attacked, not 1/5 have escaped death. The sickness attacks equally those who are in comfortable positions and who care for themselves well, and those whose means do not permit them to take precautions necessary to their health.
My position becomes worse every day. Sickness carries off the men. Toussaint is not to be trusted, as I had indeed expected, but I have drawn from his submission the object I had expected, which was to detach from him Dessalines and Christophe with their troops. I am going to order his arrest, and I think I can reckon sufficiently on Dessalines, of whose mind I have made myself master, to charge him to go and arrest Toussaint. I do not think I shall miss him. What makes me take this daring resolution, Citizen Consul, is that it is necessary for me to revive in the colony the idea of my strength by some act of rigor. But if I did not receive reinforcements, my position would become worse. Do not be surprised if I say that it is possible to miss him. For the last fortnight, this man has been extremely mistrustful. It is not that I have given any handle to his mistrust, but he regrets the power. As soon as I am assured of his person, I shall make him leave for Corsica and give orders that he should be imprisoned in one of the castles in that island. I beg you to give orders that 10,000 men be sent to me immediately. My health has been very unsteady. It is a little better, but this climate is extremely unfavorable to me. All I desire is to be able to remain here until next Vantos. I hope at that period to have sufficiently advanced my work in order that I might leave it to my successor without any anxiety. Despite the ravages made here by death, there is no discouragement in the army.